This week's episode of the New in Chess podcast features a narration from the Essential Sasanko, a collection of chess portraits and stories authored by chess grandmaster Genna Sasanko. The subject of this week's episode is Ukrainian grandmaster Efim Geller. Efim Petrovich Geller was a 2-time Soviet chess champion and a 6-time candidate for the World Chess Championship. He faced 10 different world champions, scoring victories against 8 of them, and even coming out with a positive overall score, plus 39 to 36 equals 131. Genna, who ran into Geller several times over the years, paints a compelling portrait of the somewhat underappreciated by history grandmaster. Enjoy this week's episode of the New in Chess podcast.
Efim Geller, 1925 to 1998. The Chess King of Odessa. The 2nd of August 1974 was a free day before the final round of the IBM tournament. The last performance at the Tuchinsky Cinema had just finished, and I was standing on the street with Vladimir Tukmakov in the evening bustle of Amsterdam. "Do you think it would be better to offer a draw right now, or to wait for tomorrow's game?" my companion asked. He was in excellent spirits. He had led throughout the tournament, and, leading his rivals by a whole point, had practically assured himself of first place. The last round game with Efim Geller should not cause much anxiety. The tournament had not gone well for Geller. He had only a 50% score. He had nothing to aspire to. Besides, both were from Odessa, to say nothing of the fact that they would have to report back to the USSR Sports Committee. "I decided not to knock on his door," Tukmakov recalled the following day at the closing ceremony of the tournament, in which he shared first to third places. A strip of light was showing from under the door, on the handle of which hung a "Do Not Disturb" sign, and I distinctly heard the tapping of chess pieces on a board. Although the game from the last round lasted 40 moves, Tukmakov effectively did not survive the opening. His position was already hopeless, somewhere around move 15. Now, a quarter of a century later, I can picture well the Geller of that time. A man of few words with a characteristic facial expression, frequent rocking of the head, accompanied by a sceptical raising of the eyebrows, his check jacket, which he carefully hung on the back of his chair, and the ashtray, full of cigarette ends, always alongside him. In those days, it was permitted to smoke directly at the board, and he smoked a great deal. Obstinate, with a dimpled chin and a slow waddle, Geller's entire appearance was more that of a former boxer or an elderly bosun who had come ashore rather than the world-class grandmaster he was. It was with this same gait that he walked onto the stage of the Central House of Railway Workers in Moscow back in 1949 for his first USSR championship, in order to remain in the world chess elite for several decades. For all those years, he stood at the very summit of the chess pyramid of his country, about which Hans Rey once said, "When I am in the USSR, I have the feeling that every tram conductor plays chess better than I do." But then, back in 1949, a sensation occurred. A win in the last round with White against Kolmov would give the young player from Odessa, who had only just become a master, the championship gold medal. In a Rue Lopez, where Kolmov had chosen the rare bird variation, Geller proved unprepared and lost. This was to happen to Geller on more than one occasion. Such a defeat in the last round, often in very important games, against Keres in a match, for example, or against Sachs in Moscow in the last round of the Interzonal. Excessive emotion? A gambling instinct? A striving for the maximum? At the time of his Moscow debut, Geller was 24 years old, which is by no means young by the standards of today, but for Geller, the best years for his development as a chess player came during the war, when there was no time for chess. He became a grandmaster 3 years later, and in 1953 he was playing in his first candidates event, the famous Zurich tournament. He was to qualify for 6 such candidates events during his career, in one of which, in 1962, he finished just half a point behind the winner, Petrosian. There were victories in numerous international tournaments, close on 10 Olympiads, and participation in 23 championships of the USSR, the strongest chess power in the world. He won this championship twice, the first time in 1955, and the second in 1979 at the age of 54, an amazing record. But it was not just a question of competitive laurels and titles. Efim Geller left his own vivid mark on chess. Vasily Smyslov calls him a genuine chess classic.
He was at the forefront when chess was flourishing in our empire. He defeated all the leading players without exception. As for the fact that he did not become world champion, this is granted from above. For this, you need to have a particular star in your fate. Geller was not granted this star, but he was a splendid, vivid, dynamic player.
Boris Spassky describes Geller as a very complete player. He was very thoughtful, and under his completeness and thoughtfulness, even Fischer often cracked. When Geller was on song, he could crush anyone. I always admired this thoughtfulness of his. Not only the excellently played opening, this goes without saying, but the thoughtfulness of his play after it, the planning. He was a grandmaster of very high class, and he would play one or two games a year which would determine the direction the chess took in this or that opening. Such a game was his win against Smyslov in the Grunfeld defence in the 1965 match, where he several times sacrificed his queen.
Anatoly Karpov says, Geller's ideas were deep, although Botvinnik in his time said to me, all Geller's ideas should be checked 3 times. And indeed, if he got carried away, he could miss something in analysis. He was incredibly obstinate, but perhaps in chess it is sometimes not a bad thing to uphold your ideas. In a training group he was difficult. He tried to push the others aside, and for this reason at some point I stopped working with him.
Mark Tarmanov describes him as a maximalist.
Geller had his own clearly formed creative credo. He possessed great strategic imagination, and he was utterly devoted to the game. We played an enormous number of games, one of the most memorable of which was in the last round of the USSR Championship in 1952, when he won against me and Botvinnik won by some miracle against Suetin, so that Botvinnik caught me. Geller always strove for the utmost. I remember the Aliekhin Memorial in Moscow in 1956, which would now be called a super tournament. The world champion and all the strongest grandmasters were playing, Botvinnik, Smyslov, Bronstein, Keres, Gligorich, Neidorf, Szabo and Unzicker. Geller himself did not play in the tournament. Well, 5th place would be all right, I replied to his question of how I thought I would do. He smiled characteristically. Without thinking about 1st place, I simply could not play. In general, the players of our generation, Averbakh, Geller, I, and to a lesser extent Bronstein and Petrosian, were trained to do constant and deep analytical work. Still, in this respect, I think that Geller stood out amongst us. Geller's analytical work always had one aim, to find the best move in the position, not simply a good one, but the best, which would determine the very essence of the position. He was completely engrossed in chess, completely focused on it. Lev Albert, remembering Geller in Odessa in the late 50s, remarked on his rare combination of diligence and inventiveness and a complete absence of superficiality.
If there is an expression down to earth, then about Geller one can definitely say down to chess.
What do you mean, draw? What are you talking about? Geller lectured me after I had lost to Janser in Amsterdam in 1974.
You stood better. Where? Well, show me the game. Show me. I feel offended for the position. This offended for the position, I hear, as if it were said yesterday.
Every morning in the Crimea, where we were preparing for the match with Fischer, Spassky recalls, I saw Geller looking at one and the same position, the Sicilian with the black queen on b2. He tried this and that, both with the rook at b1 and other setups, although I said to him that the correct idea was putting the knight on b3. But he kept insisting on his own view. He was very obstinate. His diligence was extraordinary. He developed his talent by sitting on his backside, and his backside in turn developed thanks to his talent. Geller himself said, If I feel anxious or uncomfortable, I sit down at the chessboard for some 5 to 6 hours and gradually come to. According to those who knew him closely, he could be in such a state for days. Clearly the time that Geller spent analysing greatly exceeded the hours that the chess clock was ticking alongside and an opponent was sitting opposite. Chess did not leave him, day or night. Sometimes in his sleep he would whisper chess moves, his widow, Oksana, remembers, or, on waking up at night, he would go over to the table to write down some variation that had suddenly come to mind. At the Olympiad in Lucerne in 1982, I talked to him about expanding my opening repertoire. Geller advised me to include the closed Chigorin variation of the Roux Lopez. I asked him, And how much time would be needed to master it? He thought briefly, At your level? I used to play regularly at Tilburg and at Vikensee, the strongest tournaments in the world. To compile everything, process, understand and apply it? Well, 1.5 years. Of course, this was in pre-computer times, but what is characteristic is the approach itself to the question. He understood at an early age the ancient truth that success awaits he who is well prepared. His knowledge of the opening was exceptionally deep, and the words of Botvinnik are well known. Before Geller, we did not really understand the king's Indian defence. In opening theory, there is always the concept of what is in vogue. Geller never paid any attention to this, being himself the legislator of fashion, following his own ideas and principles. At the interzonal tournament in Petropolis in 1973, Bronstein, after choosing a difficult variation of the Aliakhin defence and losing to Geller practically without a struggle, tried to justify himself. But what should I have played against him? After all, he knows everything. While splendidly playing the start of the game, Geller himself understood very well that the opening is only the prelude to the struggle. He knew that you have to be ready for everything, from a sharp middle game to a tedious end game, from passive defence to rapid tempo play. He said to the young Dorfman about Belyavsky and Romanishin, who were already established in the USSR arena, Don't take them as examples. They are one-sided players, emphasising, in his opinion, their predilection to a certain type of position. From many of Geller's games, one can learn the highest technique of the game, technique which, according to the definition of Vladimir Horowitz, is nothing other than to have a completely clear impression of what you want and to possess the full potential for completely fulfilling this task. This definition of technique is applicable not only to music, but also to chess. Efim Geller possessed such technique. Viktor Korchnoi noted, In his best game, Geller approached the level of genius. Although it was he who I had in mind when I wrote in my autobiography that genius and evil are compatible things, there were all these intrigues and plots against me by him and Petrosian. I played my first game against Geller in the championship of the Nauka Sports Society in 1951, and I lost with black in a Shara Henning gambit. He was a brilliant player, of course, and he introduced much that was new into the theory of the opening. Perhaps someone played this way earlier, but his handling, for example, of the unprepossessing move Bishop E2 in the Sicilian forced the whole complex of these positions to be looked at anew. In his younger years, he was primarily a tactician, but then he grew up and began handling in his own way both the opening and chess in general. But as for his human qualities... Geller did indeed begin as a tactician, although he himself, looking back at a mature age, recalled, "I understood the importance of the strategic side of the game, even in those years when I would bring out my rooks in front of my pawns and launch a wild piece attack. But in the late 50s to early 60s, I experienced an internal change. It would not be right to consider this a shift from tactics to strategy. If one tries to express what it consisted of, it can only be a question of a gradual, continuous shift to deeper play. I was never lazy, but in 1958 to 60, I really began studying in earnest." One of the best-known examples of his analytical talent was the brilliant draw in the seemingly hopeless adjourned position from the Botvinnik-Fischer game at the Varna Olympiad in 1962. Botvinnik later admitted that it was Geller who, deep into the night, found the paradoxical idea that saved the game. Two separated pawns successfully opposed two connected passed pawns, in contradiction, seemingly, to all the laws of rook endings. The idea came completely unexpected to Fischer. However, there is a great difference between analysis and the actual process of playing. A game of chess is not a theorem, and the one who wins is by no means always the most logical and consistent, but often the one with the greatest endurance, the one who is the most practical, clever, or simply lucky. It sounds paradoxical, but the depth of Geller's ideas, the search for the best and only move, often rebounded on him. His deficiencies were the direct continuation of his virtues. Thinking for an hour or more would lead to time trouble, and sometimes the edifice, lovingly constructed over a period of hours, would come unstuck in a few minutes. It was no accident that the number of games that Geller lost by overstepping the time limit was rather high. At such moments, his appearance would be completely vacant, and his arm would simply not raise itself to make a bad move, or the first one that came to hand. Tal once remarked that the number of one-move blunders by Geller was greater than by any other grandmaster of his class. The explanation was often the same. Perched on his high thoughts, Geller sometimes did not notice the obvious. "He cannot behold what is under his feet, and imagines that he can discern what is in the sky," laughed the Thracian girl at the philosopher, who had fallen into the same trap more than 2,000 years ago. "After making this move, I immediately noticed another, better one," Geller himself once recalled. "After this, I simply could no longer play this game." A feeling which, I am sure, is completely unfamiliar, for example, to Karpov, who would have imperturbably continued fighting in the newly changed situation. The striving for logic and completeness more than once played an adverse role for Geller, the practical player. He also had another vulnerable point. He had, as Spassky put it, a glass jaw. Geller would lose his way when faced with unexpected counterplay. When such play begins, it was difficult for him, and therefore he simply could not adapt to me, the former world champion recalls. In the Geller-Korchnoi candidates match in 1971 in Moscow, I was Korchnoi's second. It was the seventh game that proved decisive. The game was adjourned and would be resumed the following day. Although Korchnoi, as white, had the better position, no matter how we tried, we could not find a direct win. We took a time out before the resumption, which was still possible in those days.
But even a whole day of analysis did not produce anything concrete. It was then that we decided on a practical approach. Immediately after resuming the game, instead of lengthy positional manoeuvring, Korchnoi would sacrifice a piece. Objectively, given correct defence, this sacrifice should have led to a draw. But Geller immediately thought for a long time, ended up in time trouble, and lost effectively without a struggle. The match was decided. It is no accident that, while noting Geller's remarkable talent, Korchnoi once remarked that sometimes he could simply be taken by storm.
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way. On-the-spot reports of the biggest events. Top-notch instruction. Independent journalism. Chess history that comes to life. And great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website newinchess.com/magazine for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
But it was not only a change of situation on the board that was his vulnerable point. A game of chess is full of emotions, very often invisible to the spectators, and Geller was not always able to keep his emotions under control. At the tournament in Las Palmas in 1980, with black in the basic position of the Queen's Indian, he castled on the sixth move and offered me a draw. He had obviously taken this decision beforehand. Now, he calmly surveyed the board from the height of his rating and renown and the positive score that he had built up against me by that time. I considered briefly, said that I wanted to play on, and replied with a pawn sacrifice that had just come into fashion. Geller's face completely changed. He turned his glance from me to the board, to Petrosian, who was standing behind me, and again to the board, not making a reply for a quarter of an hour. Finally, he controlled himself and took the pawn. This game ended in a draw, but with Fischer in Mallorca at the Interzonal in 1970, it turned out differently. On that occasion, Geller decided not to risk the complications of the Sicilian, and on his first move with white, brought out his king's knight. Fischer, in turn, decided against playing the king's Indian and chose a classical setup. 16 years later, it was to occur frequently in Karpov's match with Kasparov, when Karpov would try to exploit white's minimal advantage. But Geller, after taking a pawn on the seventh move, offered a draw. Fischer's first reaction was to laugh. Geller, too, began to laugh. The situation was clear. The American was black, he had lost his three previous games to Geller, and the position was completely symmetrical. Suddenly, Fischer stopped laughing, bent down, and said something to Geller. Geller did not understand foreign languages. I saw many times how someone would address him in English or German. A broad smile usually appeared on his face, and he would amicably nod his head whatever was said to him. It is not known what Fischer said, although one of the spectators asserted that he distinctly heard, "Too early." But whatever it was that the future world champion said to Geller, it became clear to the latter that Fischer wanted to continue the game. Geller went terribly red, and just two moves later, in the simple position, he thought for a whole hour. Within a few more moves, he found himself a pawn down. The rook ending that soon arose was, however, level. The game was adjourned, but it did not prove possible for Geller to restore his emotional equilibrium. After the resumption, a draw seemed inevitable until on the 71st move he made a fatal mistake. He himself understood perfectly well that here it was a matter not just of squares and diagonals, After losing by a crushing score to Spassky, he wrote about his opponent. His staggering calmness and composure enable him at the most difficult moments to find the best practical measures. The amazing imperturbability and confidence with which he sometimes makes moves that are by no means good certainly puts his opponents in an ambiguous position. Geller himself was far from imperturbable. Whereas in play with representatives of his own generation, such as Taimanov or Bronstein, things were limited to an internal struggle, with the younger players, he, excitable and emotional, could not keep himself under control, sometimes even during a game. Yusuf Dorfman remembers,
"In the last round of the Zonal USSR Championship in Yerevan in 1982, I needed a win to qualify for the interzonal tournament, whereas a draw would suit Geller. When I was considering my move, Geller, standing opposite, said, leaning over the board, 'All the same, you won't win against me.' The game ended in a draw, and Geller, who had now calmed down, apologised."
The Hergovins tournament of 1975 was an unusually strong one. I was in the leading group with +3, and in the 12th round, I had White against Geller, who had 50%. It should not be forgotten that only 3 years earlier, I had left the USSR and simply did not exist there, having been vaporised in Orwellian language. This game, therefore, apart from its competitive aspect, also had another one for Geller. He tried to intimidate me completely during the game, looking daggers at me and bashing the clock. After recording a move, he would noisily place a pawn on his score sheet, adding to it a queen or a rook. But immediately after I resigned, he changed into good nature itself. Maybe he would have done better to take with the pawn on e5. I also heard similar stories from other players, younger than himself. I think that here it was partly the fact that he himself had never been a child prodigy, or one of the favoured, highly promising, who, as it seemed to him, received much that was ready prepared and undeserved. There was also something here from the bosun, or the tutor, sternly teaching the young to think sensibly. But mainly, it was something else, and he himself expressed it best. At the USSR Championship in Vilnius in 1980, Geller found it very hard going. Severe time trouble in almost every game, blunders and blood pressure approaching breaking point. "Perhaps it would be best to withdraw, Efim Petrovich," they cautiously advised him. "Withdraw? What do you mean, withdraw? What about my stipend and international tournaments and my place in the team? It's easy for you to say withdraw." Of course, in any type of sport, especially professional sport, the difference between winning and losing is appreciable, but nowhere was it so enormous as in the Soviet Union. Chess enjoyed a privileged position compared with other types of sport, and a decent result at a tournament in the West was equivalent to several annual salaries. On a single half point, often depended not only your entire future career, but also the well-being of your family. Many who travelled for the first time to a tournament abroad knew that there would not be another similar opportunity. This enormous responsibility could have the most unexpected consequences. Thus, at the tournament in Weikensee in 1964, Leivonnet, who was not even a grandmaster, shared first place with Keres, ahead of Portish, Ivkov, Larsen, and many other well-known grandmasters. On the other hand, the performance of Igor Platonov 6 years later, again at Weikensee, was a complete failure, -4 on one of the bottom places. Even famous grandmasters at the very top of the gigantic pyramid in the USSR could not vouch for their future. Their chess career could be cut short for an indefinite period at any time, and sometimes be altogether destroyed. I think that it was primarily this, and not just differences in character and mentality, that explains the frequently prickly, watchful, and often openly hostile relations which always accompanied the top of Soviet chess. What with visits to the sports committee, with letters to party organs and other bodies, with the favour or malice of the all-powerful party officials on whom often hung your fate, and whose names have long since sunk into oblivion. As Spassky remarked, playing against Fischer, especially when the latter was very young, Geller, with his entire appearance and facial expression, showed, "You're just a little shit aspiring to be a genius," an attitude which Fischer certainly sensed. I also remember a training session of the Russian team before one of the Spartakiads, where we were looking at the Shveshnikov variation. Shveshnikov himself was giving the demonstration. You should have seen Geller then. He contemptuously pursed his lips, rolled his eyes and sighed loudly, saying that you couldn't play this way, that Black's position was full of holes, while he completely overlooked Black's trumps. I have to give Shveshnikov his due. Others would have got angry, but he behaved impeccably. No, Geller was not a good-natured person. Rather, he worked under the pretense of being so. But he helped me a great deal during my match with Petrosian in 1969, and in the match with Fischer, he was effectively the only one who really helped me. Neither Ney nor Krogius helped me, nor did Boleslavsky, who arrived at the very end, having analysed openings which did not, in fact, occur in the match, whereas Geller really worked and suffered. Although practically all those who he trained lost their matches, here there was, I think, also a degree of envy. Why him and not me? Well, and obstinacy, often hostile, these feelings sometimes prevailed over his remarkable chess qualities. No, I do not think that he made any intrigues, but he was certainly a very tricky person, that is for sure. He was good-natured, but not sentimental, an outwardly good-natured man from Odessa, although, of course, he was an opportunist and did everything that was advantageous to him. When it suited him, he went over to Karpov. During my reign as champion, I followed one piece of his advice, although I didn't used to listen to anyone and preferred to go my own way. Boris Vasilievich, you are world champion. You stand at the summit. Don't interfere with the affairs of the candidates in their disputes, their problems. They are not your affair, not the affair of the champion. I retain good memories of him. Geller's last few chess years were difficult ones, although he himself, just before his 50th birthday, wrote that we should not close our eyes to the fact that we all, sooner or later, lose the game to the severe and invincible opponent, time. One always likes to believe that this relates to others and not to oneself. There is no secret. With the advancing years, you have to work more, that's all, he said after winning the USSR championship at the age of 54. But very soon he realized that no amount of analysis and no amount of work can compensate for the effortlessness, enormous desire, and willpower of the young. Accustomed to analysing everything and always delving for the truth, he himself gave this diagnosis of a player of advancing years. What is reduced, more than anything, is stability in calculating the numerous little variations that comprise the ordinary fabric, positional play in the usual jargon. The danger of oversights increases. These normally occur off stage and do not take the form of actual blunders. One is able to diverge from the fatal path at the last minute, only at the cost of a greater or lesser worsening of the position. But from the side, this looks almost like incomprehension. Nevertheless, he remained true to himself, uncompromising, upholding his chess correctness. If it seemed to Geller that the laws of chess had been broken, that something had been done not according to the rules, he would again sink into lengthy thought, considering it his duty to punish, to refute, to demonstrate. He who has not the courage to carry out his ideas loses the ability of a fighter and is approaching his twilight, wrote Lasker. Right to the end, Geller had the courage to carry out his ideas, but he lacked the strength. He lost without scoring in both his mini-matches at the knockout tournament in Tilburg,
to Chandler in 1992 and to Van Vele the following year. Yet in none of the games did he forego his principles by prematurely reducing the tension or neutralizing the position. "I just don't have the strength anymore," he said with an apologetic smile. I also remember how, towards the end of 1987, on his return from India, where he had lost to a 17-year-old youth who had spent somewhere in the region of half an hour on the entire game, I asked him, "What's this I hear about you losing to a little boy, Efim Petrovich?" trying to strike the right note. "Little boy?" He looked at me with disapproval. "I may have lost to a future world champion."
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT introduced digital clocks to the chess world at a time when only analog clocks were used. For over 30 years, DGT has been making the official FIDE chess clock, endorsed by the World Chess Federation. DGT clocks are the world's best-selling chess clocks, the standard in chess timing and used everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
I do not think that Geller, even in his best years, would have been comfortable in modern chess. Not only because of all the rapid and blitz tournaments of which he was never a supporter, "I never was a blitz player," he said, after he had not even scored 50% in a blitz tournament in Amsterdam in 1975. I think also that the new time control, which punishes lengthy thinking, the disappearance of adjourned games, and the prominent role of the computer in opening preparation, would have neutralized his natural qualities. These developments would have run counter to the type of chess in which he grew up and in which he gained outstanding successes. Yet a lot of what seems obvious and straightforward in present-day chess is based on positions and principles which were developed by the best players and analysts of the 50s, 60s and 70s, and one of the most significant of these was Efim Geller. He was born into and grew up in a Jewish family in Odessa. Although he was quite indifferent to his Jewishness, it was that he was regarded as a Jew, in the words of his widow, Oksana, a phrase which will be understandable to anyone who grew up in the Soviet Union. I do not think, however, that his Jewish background caused him any concrete problems. He was not a Jew with a violin or a refined intellect, rather the opposite, a Jewish craftsman, not an unusual type in the Ukraine or in Russia. With his way of life, he fully blended in with the environment and the country where he lived, but his craft was chess. He lived in the USSR practically all his life, until the moment when that country simply ceased to exist. It is not surprising that in many ways he remained a Soviet person. But he was never a party member, although in his book he talks in stronger than acceptable terms about the advantages of the socialist system and condemns Fischer as a typical representative of the rotten capitalist system. In 1972 in Reykjavik, as Spassky's second, right towards the end of the hopelessly lost match against Fischer, he demanded an official inspection of the tournament hall for the purpose of discovering some secret electronic apparatus or rays which could be influencing Spassky's thinking. Viktor Bacharinsky, who was then the chief of the chess department of the sports committee in the Soviet Union, recalls, "It was Geller's personal initiative. Moscow did not give any authorization." One can laugh and speak ironically about this, but at the time, Geller simply could not find any other reason for Spassky's weak play. This accords very well with the ideas developed in him from childhood of the sealed border, the Colorado beetle scattered by the Americans on fields of collective farms, and intrigues by imperialists of every colour, demanding high vigilance and a stern rebuff. He guarded the interests of the empire, the servant and pride of which he was simultaneously. In 1970,
At the match Soviet Union versus rest of the world in Belgrade, he complained to journalists that wins by representatives of the rest of the world team were being greeted with considerably greater applause than those by the Soviet grandmasters. In an article in 64, written by him after he and I had shared third place in the Hergovens tournament in 1977, my name was altogether absent. I do not think, however, that it was crossed out by the journal editors. Geller's self-censorship sufficed. In 1980 in Las Palmas, I asked him to sign a copy of his book on the King's Indian defence, which had just been published. After lengthy, agonising thought, he wrote, "With best wishes," without any form of address or signature, just in case anyone should see it, and, averting his eyes, handed the book to me. But those were then the rules of the game, and he simply did not know any others. When, in the late 80s, in the final already convulsive years of the Soviet Union, the question of the participation of Soviet players in the GMA was being discussed in the Central Chess Club in Moscow, Geller, as Psakis recalls, was categorically against. "It is no accident that the head office of this organisation is in Brussels, since the headquarters of NATO are also there." But normally, he was a man of few words, and therefore in obituaries in the West, while giving his outstanding chess achievements their due, they wrote at the same time about the completely unknown Geller as a person. "He wasn't an eloquent speaker, rather, I would say, inarticulate," recalls Tukmakov. "Not being a stupid person, he knew this himself and preferred to hold his tongue, especially in a crowd or in unfamiliar company." About his character, Taimanov said, "He could be prickly, and he could be offensive even at a team meeting. But he and I were once together on a trip for a week, and he suddenly revealed another side, warm and sincere. Of course, he was from Odessa. There was something of a daredevil in him, something also of a common labourer, with corresponding manners." In the words of Karpov, "He could play billiards for days on end. He liked playing cards and, of course, pinochle. He was from Odessa. Everything about him was from Odessa, including his speech. The way that he spoke, they speak in Odessa, in Haifa, in Brighton Beach." For the last 30 of his allotted 73 years, Geller lived in Moscow, but Odessa always remained home for him. He came from an Odessa alley where everyone knew everyone else and knew everything about everyone else. Albert and Tukmakov, whose chess childhood came at the end of the 50s, recall that he was a favourite son of Odessa. He was a simple man, not an intellectual and not a philosopher. He liked to eat without paying attention to calories and cholesterol, and liked to sit in a group and drink with friends, like a character from one of Babel's stories, enjoyed playing cards, dominoes or billiards. It was all this, too, that made him popular in Odessa. Fima Geller from Odessa. In old age, like many others, he began to resemble a caricature of himself. His facial features became even larger, his tendency to corpulence exceeded acceptable bounds, and the considerable dimensions of his stomach, given his modest height, became even more marked. He breathed heavily, but would not part with his invariable cigarette. Both his outer appearance and his manners contrasted sharply with his pure and classical style of play. During his chess career, Geller was abroad dozens of times. "There he would relax," Spassky recalls. "For him this meant the following. He would light up his Chesterfield, drink Coca-Cola, and be outside of time and space." The last few years were not easy. It was not just his shaky health. As for many of his generation, the foundations of his perception of the world had been shaken. At one time, the family thought about going to America. I'm not sure that, especially in his final ailing years,
he would have felt at home there. In general, old trees do not lend themselves well to transplanting. And yet, why not? Had he not been given his enormous chess talent, which made him who he became, I could well see him shuffling dominoes on a sun-drenched promenade at Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, at a table in the Odessa restaurant, or sitting on a bench reading the newspaper New Russian Word. As a child, he lived in Pushkin Street, which led to the railway station, then by the seaside. Malaya Arnotskaya, Grekskaya, Evreshkaya, and Deribasovskaya, streets of Odessa straight as an arrow, well trodden and familiar from his childhood and youth, he often returned to them, the last time 3 years before his death on his 70th birthday, in the city which, as Babel expressed it, supplied child prodigies to all the concert halls in the world. Here, Sviatoslav Richter began, and David Oistrakh, and Emil Galels. The outstanding grandmaster Efim Petrovich Geller was the absolute favourite of Odessa, its chess king. Fame, as is known, has only one value, to place it at the feet of those whom you love. In his case, it was his family, his wife Oksana, his only son Sasha, whom he greatly loved, and in the words of those who knew the family well, sometimes excessively. It was with him, quite a strong player, that Geller played the last two games of his life, giving his son, in both games, the white pieces. All these years, he lived in a dacha at Peredelkino on the outskirts of Moscow. He suffered a long and serious illness, and he often sat silent, sometimes smiling a childish, innocent smile. A gradual shrinking of the soul was taking place. Winter that year came early, hard and frosty. That was also how it was on the day of Geller's funeral, November 20, 1998. His grave is close to the house where he lived, the cemetery being a 15-minute walk away. In a last word at his grave, David Bronstein, who knew Geller for half a century, said that all his life, Geller was engaged in seeking the truth. But what truth there is in chess is elusive and illusory. All the same, day and night, he kept searching for it. Efim Geller was one of the most striking representatives of a now departed generation, which is becoming chess history. Not far off is the time when chess itself, or at any rate, the chess that they played, will also be history.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. We thank our voice actor, Nick Murphy, our producer, Alex Pollock, and of course our sponsor, DGT, for their support, and hope to have you back soon for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.